Okay, welcome everybody to episode 34 of the Academy of Management Origin series. In episode 34 here, we're going to uncover the story behind the paper, Continue the Story or Turn the Page, Coworker Reactions to Inheriting a Legacy. And this is a paper written by five authors, Jason Colquitt, Tyler Burns-Sabey, Jessica Rodell and Edwina Hill. And Tyler is going to be the one representing the team as we talk about this here today. So Tyler, if we can start off just with you giving a little bit of an introduction about yourself, who you are, where you're currently located, what's your research identity, and then we'll get a little bit deeper into the rest of the team.
Sounds great. Well, thanks for having me. This is a great series. I'm happy to be on here. So as Greg mentioned, I'm Tyler Sabey. I'm currently at Arizona State University. Just got here this last semester. In terms of research identity, I see myself in sort of two streams, social hierarchies and social interactions, and then pro-social behaviors and how we can help other people in the world. So that's sort of a little bit about me thus far.
Awesome. And so you've obviously worked with these four other co-authors. Tell us a little bit about each one of them and your connection back to them and how this team came to work together.
Yeah. So great author team. I loved working with them and hope to continue to work with them on other papers. So first, Jason Colquitt. So we, all of us at one point were at University of Georgia when the project started. So Jason and Jessica were two of my advisors there. I was a student there at the time. And so the two of them were two of my advisors. Jessica is my primary advisor, and I've worked a lot with both of them. And so we came up with these ideas in sort of conversation. Edwina was there as well. She was a PhD student at the time with me. And so the two of us were kind of learning the ropes together. And then Mike Farr, also at Georgia, we brought him on for his AMR expertise. I was always excited to hopefully work with him. He's more of a macro scholar, and so you know, not a whole lot of overlap in that way. So this was a good opportunity, I think, at least for me, to be able to work with Mike. And so it was a great author team. And again, we've, you know, several of us have moved to different locations. Jason's now at Notre Dame, and Edwina's at South Carolina, and I'm here at ASU. But it all started back in Athens during my PhD. So
awesome. Well, that's it's a good thing to get started early, to get started on your PhD, and it sounds like you got the right people around you to help make all of that happen. So the paper is Continue the Story or Turn the Page, Coworker in Reactions to Inheriting a Legacy. What's the essence or the high level sort of idea and nuance behind this paper? What would you say if you were to sort of try and sum it up in a short space of time?
Yeah, so I think there are two general takeaways. Hopefully, one is you know, so much of the legacy space thus far, the research has focused on kind of the upper echelons and you know, the people you would think of as leaving a legacy, CEOs or founders. And when we got thinking about this and talking about it, we realized, you know, other people can leave a legacy, whether it's, you know, a lower level leader or a star employee, or even just one of your coworkers. When these people leave a work unit, there are times where it feels a bit of a shock. And they've left a legacy. They left something behind. And so that's, I think, our first takeaway. The second is really, you know, so then what? You know, what happens after these people leave this work unit, and what do people do inheriting this legacy? So again, thus far in the research, it's mostly been up to the point of, okay, someone leaves an organization, and we haven't really talked much about what happens after that. How do people continue this legacy, or how do people get rid of this legacy, and how does it live on, or how does it die off? And so that kind of goes to the title. How, you know, can we continue the story as sort of championing this legacy, or do we turn the page and focus on in a different direction?
So there's the notion that someone within a work unit creates some kind of imprint or connection with what's happening in that space. And then when they leave, maybe they go to another job, maybe they pass on, maybe they get promoted to go elsewhere. There could be a positive sort of ramification or a desire for other people in that work unit to continue some of what they may have brought to the table, or there may be the desire for some of those people to almost want to change things because they want to almost get rid of what was there. And there's the sort of dual-sided potential outcome of that. Have I interpreted that correctly?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's well said. That's exactly what we're going for.
Yeah. So one of the things that intrigued me about the paper was you really double down on a metaphor in order to conceptualize this idea of a legacy. And the metaphor is one of a footprint, and a footprint sort of being left behind after someone's gone, and then sort of utilize that to sort of articulate key aspects or dimensions of what may happen in the wake of someone leaving or the implications of someone having left something behind. Can you explain to us, number one, what is the essence of this metaphor? And then number two, what was the sort of genesis of actually coming up with this metaphor and then deciding to make it sort of so central in at least one segment of the paper?
Yeah, so it really started when kind of thinking about the definitions of a legacy and what a legacy is. There's some of the definitions might have, you said, imprint. And so originally when we were talking about this idea, we had kind of strung along this example, right, of a footprint, and we had talked about it just sort of as an author team, and how it was a good metaphor. You know, you can leave a deep footprint, you can leave a shallow footprint, you can have different, you know, content within there. And it got to the point where we realized we should actually be using this, you know, not in just our talking during our sort of author discussions, but this actually helps to really explain this process, or how we see it at least. And so, like you said, we doubled down on this metaphor and you know, focused on the three elements of it, whether it's the content, right? So you see a footprint, you see the tread, the different you know, traction and elements that you can see it and similar. You know, you have a legacy, and it's something that's, there's something, there's content behind this legacy. There's the magnitude. You know, footprints can be big, they can be small, they can be long and short, and similar. You know, your legacy can touch a lot of people, it can touch you know, not very many people, and so it, you know, it really varies in terms of its size. And then the durability. You plant your foot. And then depending on where it is and what goes on after that, which is sort of the impetus of our paper, that will dictate the durability of that footprint. And similar to a legacy, you know, you step down, and then whatever happens after will determine how durable this is, or how long lasting this legacy is, right? So if it's in the sand and the beach comes and washes it up, then it's not going to last very long. But if it's in concrete and it hardens, and it's going to stay a long time. And so, as you said, we really doubled down on this, and we liked this metaphor. And I think it was Jason ultimately that kind of thought, you know, we just need to use this. And I think it helps to really paint the picture of what a legacy is and the elements of a legacy that we're trying to speak to.
Yeah. And it also, I mean, on a very subtle level, sort of invokes the idea that anyone can leave a legacy, in the sense that everyone Absolutely. Leaves footprints behind. It's not only certain people within the upper echelons or with certain criteria that are going to leave a footprint, but almost anywhere you go, you're going to leave a footprint, and the extent to which that's durable and the content of that might vary and so on. So it sort of echoes that sentiment of the paper. So I thought it was a particularly interesting feature of what you did, because we don't often see, conceptual papers, often there is to some extent a metaphor invoked, but not so explicitly and so central to at least the core construct that you're theorizing around. So I think one of the things I will say is that to do so, you've got the team has to write very well, very articulately, very clearly. And that's one of the very strong features of this paper, is the writing is just exceptional. And so that makes the metaphor work, because you're never sort of questioning what's going on. So well done on that. Can you tell us how the project actually got started? So even before you start talking about footprints in the sand, what's the genesis of all of this? How did it get started and so on? Why did you want to write about legacy?
Yeah, so it was kind of interesting. I was, interested in PhD programs, and when you fill out your application to PhD programs, you write a statement of purpose, or they're called different things. And so you have to, you think of some ideas and you think you know what you're talking about, and you realize you really don't. But one of the things that I wrote about in my statement of purpose was this notion of a legacy. And for some reason, I've always been fascinated with this idea. I think thinking back to my upbringing or my, schooling or even work experience, and thinking about the people that have left an impact on my life, that have sort of left a legacy to me, whether they be coaches or friends or just coworkers, I've always thought about this. It's an interesting social dynamic. And though you don't see these people anymore, they still have this lasting impact or this legacy on you. And so, again, in my naive mind, I wrote about that in my statement of purpose and thought it was a great idea. Unbeknownst to me, Jason kind of was thinking of this idea of legacy as well. He had recently moved from University of Florida to the University of Georgia. He had spent, 10 years or so at Florida before he went to Georgia. And, I think in his mind, after leaving there, he was doing some kind of sense making about, what have I left to this program? What is my legacy there at Florida? And I'm probably putting words in his mouth. This is my assumption. But and so I think he thought to himself, what is it that I've left? What is my legacy there? And so I think that was kind of back of his mind as well. And I think we realized, we have this connection here. We're both interested in this concept that's, not very well studied yet in our fields. When you have even just a construct that is unusual or interesting, and you're able to, spit ideas back and forth with each other, that's kind of how it really started, in terms of his interest in legacy and my interest in legacy as well.
And so at what point in the process do you decide, or do you figure out, or do you come to the conclusion that actually the opportunity here is for legacy from people who are lower down in organizational hierarchies, as opposed to we automatically want to associate it with the most powerful person in the room, the person with the most influence, the person with who's in the leadership position. And yet you arrive at this place where you recognize, and then you articulate it well in the paper. But I'd love to know a little bit about when you first come to the recognition that, oh, there's an opportunity to theorize around legacy at a different level from what we would automatically default.
Yeah, I think all along that was kind of our vision. I think of and particularly because we of our own examples this was where we brought in other authors as well, and one of our first meetings was talking about examples of legacy, right? And who has impacted you. And obviously a lot of these examples were, what you just said, people with power, high high status people that you would think about, but not all of them were. And we realized that, you know, that is an interesting kind of nuance to this that we haven't looked at all. And I think from my, like I said, my experience of wanting to get into this research of legacy, it wasn't always the people that were in this upper echelons that were the ones that had this lasting impact on me. And I think Jason felt the same way. To me, Jason is always the most smartest and most powerful in a room, but I don't know if he thought that way. And so he thought, well, if I'm leaving a legacy, you know, I don't have to be at this upper echelon necessarily. This was kind of from the beginning, really. It helped that not a whole lot has been done in that space. And so that was especially reaffirming of, hey, we need to focus in this direction. But yeah, I think from the beginning, we thought this is where this needs to be because we don't focus enough on this. And I think it can have a lasting impact on these lower level employees that can actually, you know, make an impact, have a legacy on other people.
Well, it was particularly poignant for me to read this paper at this time. And there's a little bit of backstory here. So forgive me if I share it with you.
No, please.
So we have a colleague here at Indiana University who passed away earlier this semester, a guy by the name of Tim Baldwin. He had been department chair, but he had always been the sort of life and soul of our department. Even when he wasn't department chair, he was sort of the positive, sort of influential, sort of make it happen kind of guy. And interestingly enough, I believe that he was one of the people who got Jason Colquitt to think about an academic career or a career in academia as a management professor. And so because he passed away in October, legacy has been so top of mind in my thinking that when I read your paper, it was like, oh, wow, here is something that I'm actually living, and I'm living it as one of those people who are left behind after someone's moved on and experiencing really the top half of your model, which is all the positive elements of someone leaving a really poignant and meaningful legacy. So your paper was very, very salient to me in reading it just at this particular time. So can you give me a little bit of a sense of, you arrive at this notion of, oh, we've got what could potentially be an interesting independent variable, if you will, but it's a fairly sort of universal big picture kind of variable. How do you go about then figuring out what it leads to and how you dimensionalize it so that you can find some variance in different things that it might lead to? So what is the theorizing process between you and Jason and Jennifer and Edwina and so on look like, such that you start to elaborate the fact, build off the idea that you've got an interesting concept or construct, but you haven't yet done anything with it?
Yeah, that's the fun part, right, of writing in AMR. And this was my first experience in writing such a paper. And so to kind of go through this process of, okay, we think we have an interesting, as you said, we think we have an interesting IV. Now what do we do? We talking a lot with Mike Farr, who's, you know, an expert theorist, I think, and he was so great to have on his team and kind of bouncing ideas and helping us to point us in the right direction in terms of how can we get this published. But, you know, a lot of it was, you know, first we need to make this sort of taxonomy. What happens? What, you know, where do we go from here? If you were able to see the first draft compared to the end, you can see the process that we've gone through, which was a fascinating process, unlike empirical papers that when you go through these processes. But going from one notion to then blowing it up into our figure two eventually. And I think part of it was really, what is it that we're passionate about? What is it that, is so interesting about this. And again, at that point, we realized we need to focus on what happens afterwards and how do these legacies potentially last or not. And so we realized, you know, are there two paths? Can they last? Can they not? And then what are the nuances of each of these paths? And help us kind of create this two by two and that you commonly see with AMRs.
And it seems like you really hone in on the relationship between the person who's ultimately going to leave the legacy and the individuals on whom they impact. And it's in the recognition that there's people on the other end of this equation. Yeah. It's not just about the person who's leaving the legacy, but it's actually about how other people's relationship with that person that seems to unlock the, or at least to me, seems to unlock the sort of typology that you've got, and then lead right. to fairly what might at that point seem like quite obvious, but at the same time, interesting outcomes or interesting things that come from those relationships. Is that a fair way of summarizing sort of some of the steps you might have taken to build this out?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly what happened. Because as you said, not much of the paper is about the person leaving a legacy. And so we really focused in on the person inheriting this and what they do and how they approach that legacy and what they can do about it.
Yeah. And then what their follow-on behaviors might look like. And so it really, going back to the notion of an imprint, it really speaks to when that legacy leaves a very solid imprint versus when it's quite quickly rubbed out, or someone, you know, takes a broom and sweeps away the imprint as quickly as possible. So that's cool. So tell me a little bit about the process of getting it to first draft. Was there anything that struck you as interesting as part of that process, or particularly meaningful in getting it to a draft that you could actually submit for the first round? Was there anything you did that sort of felt like that made a big difference, or that really helped, or that really helped us push forward? Anything in that regard?
Yeah. So interesting, and I should back up a second. We had this idea of legacy and started to think of empirical ideas. And we had kind of drafted up a couple studies. We started doing some things. And it took us a little while to take a step back and say, you know what, we don't have theorizing here. We don't know what we're leaning on. And maybe step one is to focus on the theory here. And again, this is a relatively new construct and particularly looking at sort of the aftermath of it. And so that was our initial decision of, okay, we need to focus theoretically first before we get into the empirics. And then I would say throughout the, especially early on in the review process, this sort of aha moment, I think, the feedback we got, I think, from our first draft was we had focused on sort of both ends of this, whether both in terms of the person leaving the legacy and how they create a legacy and then curate this legacy and then what happens afterwards. And it was clear that was too big. And, you know, the first half of that, that's where we have the prior backing that we can work off of, and we need to focus on the back half, which is the people inheriting this model, this idea of legacy. And so I think that was probably the big kind of aha moment that was helpful throughout the review process of thinking, you know, in AMRs you want this idea, but it can't be too big, and so we had to kind of hone it in and realize what's most novel about this? What is the, you know, what are the areas that we're really focused on? And I think that was helpful to kind of focus in and simplify what we were thinking about. And so you can imagine looking at figure two, if that was our simplified version, then it started out pretty big. But
But there is this natural tension there in an AMR paper that, you know, we want around 35 pages. So you're double space. So you are constrained by space. You're also constrained by how much, you know, cognitive attention people want to pay when they read an AMR. And so,
right.
But at the same time, we want sort of bold ideas. We want things that are going to move the needle in terms of theory, that are going to be impactful. And so there is this constant tension behind how much do we try and do versus being deep enough and focused enough and concise enough to meaningfully develop what we need to develop within the constraints we've just referred to.
Absolutely.
And so I think part of what you experienced there was figuring out what that balance is. And for the most part, I would say for AMR authors, less is more. So honing in a little bit and going a little deeper on a smaller element of what you might have initially conceptualized. There are a few papers where I might offer recommendations in the other direction, but for 75 to 85% of the papers, it's about scaling it back and being deeper and more explicit about something as opposed to adding on additional pieces.
Right.
So thanks for that. That was useful. So was that part of initial sort of drafting and figuring this out and just getting friendly reviews, or was that through the review process that this sort of model was culled down or narrowed down and focused a little?
That was mostly through the review process, actually. Yeah, our initial submission was looking kind of at the creation and curation part of the legacy, and then throughout the review process, honing in on the more back math, the aftermath or back half of that.
Okay, so you alluded to the fact that this is the first conceptual paper you've written, and I looked at your CV, and you've done a lot of fantastic empirical work, AMJ, JAP, and so on. What, when you compare and contrast the sort of upsides and downsides of doing this kind of work where you're writing a conceptual paper versus an empirical paper, what would you, and assume this is now a new PhD student that's coming to you and says, you know, most of my work's empirical, but I'm thinking of writing a conceptual paper. What would you sort of say to them are the upsides and downsides of doing this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think this was one of the more difficult papers, I think, just without being used to it. But I would also say it was one of the more entertaining papers. And you know, I think with an empirical paper, in some ways you are, I don't know if constrained is too strong of a word, but constrained by the data. And you know, it is what it is, and that's what you're working with, which, you know, I like that. That's, you know, that's to me, that's scientific, right? But the fun about a theoretical paper is, you don't have these same constraints. And a lot of it is, you know, just thinking, and which I love to do. That's partly why I'm in this field. And so, you know, these meetings with this author string, you know, apart from the fact that I just enjoy all of them and love being around them, but they were so much fun because we could just kind of sit and think and talk, it was a different dynamic, you know, than an empirical paper, which was one, again, that I enjoyed. It was difficult. Not what I was used to. Not being constrained can be difficult. You know, that it can almost be harder in that way. When you get feedback from reviewers of, you know, this isn't quite the direction, can you look at a different direction? That's still wide open, you know, compared to run this model or change this variable, or and so there, as you said, there are pros and cons. I think it was absolutely worthwhile. Had a lot of fun doing it. It was a lot of work and learning, So, you know, would I recommend it to a PhD student? Absolutely. I think, you know, to be able to get to what I feel is the heart of this field, the heart of what we do, which is the theory, to be able to really get in the weeds and get deep into why things happen and how things happen. It's been helpful moving forward with my empirical work to have that experience and that practice of knowing, you know, how deep you can really get into this. So I think it's beneficial. I think it was enjoyable. I think it's a tough process that's worth doing. So
is there any sort of concrete advice you would give them in terms of how to go about doing it? It might be based on ideas they go after or teams they forge or ways of constructing things, order in which you do things. Any sort of specific things that you would say, well, if I was doing all of this again, I would at least do these four things or whatever it might be.
Yeah. I think first of all, your co-author, picking your co-authors is especially important. It's important in any project you do, whether empirical or theoretical, but I think it is especially important with theoretical papers, because as I said, a lot of it is just kind of sitting and thinking and talking. And if you don't like the other people, it's kind of hard to do. So that was good. You know, I loved working with these people. It was very helpful, obviously, to bring on someone with AMR expertise. So, you know, maybe my first advice is to call up Mike Farr anytime you're working on this and have him work with you. or, you know, any of these authors were great. So call up our whole author string and then we'll help you. But, you know, I think that's particularly important. I found, you know, I hadn't really been so immersed in AMR before that. And so just reading the papers and understanding what is valuable, how are these papers getting published? I don't think that's unique to AMR. I would say anytime you're submitting to any journal, it's helpful to kind of have a good basis for that. But AMRs are so unique, I think it's especially important there. So I think author team is important. I think understanding the journal is important. And then I think the last piece is there's a fine line, and we've talked on this already a little bit, but there's a fine line between being too big and being too niche. And AMR is where that's really going to get purged, because it has to be novel. It has to be big enough to make a contribution. It has to be something that you could test later. But it can't be too big. And so, you know, that's the fine line. And I don't, other than find that line, I don't know if I have great advice to how to find it, but I think if you can, that's where it's particularly important.
I mean, I think in some sense it is something of a social process. So whether it's through asking for friendly reviews, presenting your ideas and seeing how people react, or subjecting them to the review process and sort of being right, aware that you might need to purge or you might need to add on or whatever it is. But you don't always know it as a team yourself as to whether you've got that balance right. And so you got to sometimes depend on feedback from others to help guide you. And you alluded to that. I want to ask about two other things. Number one is the role or the value of having your ideas captured within a figure, and how that either preempts or follows from your writing and the order in which you sort of navigated those two things. Because you've got this, as you've alluded to, this pretty elaborate figure in figure two. of boxes and arrows and all the propositions marked out. And there's a sort of one thing leads to another kind of perception. So very clear picture of what you're talking about. And you can almost see the essence of your ideas from that. So does that flow from all the theorizing, or does it precede it? That's the first thing I want you to talk about. And then the second thing I want to ask about is just, I've already alluded to the fact that the writing in this paper just struck me as very, very good, very, very clear, not overly complex, not even overly academic. So you can read it and it doesn't feel like it's taxing you. What were some of the practices at the team level, or some of the things that you saw at the team level that sort of helped you get to that point of just very solid writing? Is it just one of the authors is just a very good writer, or were there more subtle and explicit things that you think allowed you to get to that point? So those are the two things I'd love you to talk about: just the role of the figure and where it comes and how it comes, and then the actual writing of the paper.
Yeah. So for us, I would say that the figure preceded our writing. I think step one was really to nail down what we were trying to get at. In order to do that, it's quicker to, you know, draw your figure than to try to write up a whole paper first. And so I think that was where we really started. I think once we kind of had a clear picture of what it looked like, that was helpful, I think, to then go to the drawing board in terms of how to write it. Now, it would change throughout the process. I think as we always experience, that when you start to write something and realize, oh, wait, that doesn't actually work there. That doesn't actually, so we, you know, you change and iterate. But at least for us, I think it was more having an overarching idea and understanding of where we're going with this, and then getting to the writing. I think that's how at least I was trained, at least empirically. And Jessica and Jason were both on this paper. So, a lot of what we do empirically is to get our figures done first and to get the methods done and then start writing, because you know exactly what the final product is. So I don't know if it was a product of that was how we had done things with empirical papers or not, but I felt like it was helpful both for the author team to realize, okay, this is where we are, this is what we're looking at, and then while writing, to have sort of that roadmap of where we're going. In terms of the writing, you said, is one of them just a great writer? Jason did a lot of the writing, and he is a phenomenal writer. So that's helpful when you have someone that's such a good writer on your author team. But I think in addition to that, we had, having five authors on an AMR is a bit unusual. And we recognize that. I think part of it was just our four of us had very little experience in this, and so we needed all of our minds together to come up with something. But it was helpful in that, you know, we all could read through the drafts, make corrections, and with five eyes on it. And again, I don't know if I'm recommending having that many authors on a paper normally, but with five eyes on it, it's helpful to say, this doesn't make sense to me. And until all five of us really understood it, then it wasn't clear enough, or it wasn't exactly what we were getting at. And so part of it was just having those eyes. And as you mentioned, it's a social process of reading this and being upfront and saying, I don't quite follow this. I don't know where we're going with this, and making sure that it is clear. And I think that was something that I think Mike Farr was especially good at, is harping on the idea that you have to be clear, you have to be concise in these papers, because oftentimes AMRs are it's a lot to take in from the reader's perspective, and so the clearer you can be and the more concise you can be, that's what you can control as an author here, is writing clearly. Now, whether or not it's novel or whether or not people like it, that can go through the review process, but you can control how clear you are and how articulate you are in this process. So
Yeah, I think that's just great advice for anyone who wants to increase their chances of getting an R&R, of getting it through the submission process and getting stuff published. So thank you for that. So where do you hope this paper will go? What influence do you hope it will have? What do you see as sort of future opportunities that might build from it? Do you see it as potentially leading to empirical work, or are there other theoretical angles that you think people should be thinking about? If you want to inspire a bunch of current PhD students to cite your work, where would you say there's good opportunity building from what you've done?
Well, I think the most obvious is the potential empirical work. As I said, the very beginning of our interest in legacy was we started with empirical and realized, okay, we need some theoretical backing first. And so now that we have that, I think that's a good segue into some empirical work. And this is a field that I'm interested in and can see myself continuing on and studying the notion of a legacy. And I think in this paper in particular, we're able, as we've mentioned a lot, to bring it down to the more, you know, lower level employee where, you know, organizational behavior scholars can look at these things and can dive into this. And it doesn't just have to be at this upper echelons. And so I think
it does seem like it's quite tractable that you could almost go into any organization and say, think of a person who's left right here in the last however long, or moved on from your team in the last however long. How would you classify yourself in relation to that person? Did you identify with them or not? Did you feel like you could almost invoke a psychological ownership scale to assess whether they did they sense any rivalry? So I think a combination of sort of things it seems like it could quite easily be gotten at in an empirical context. So I could see how it could lead to a lot of that kind of work.
Yeah, and that was helpful. Keeping that, I think that was always in the back of our mind of, you know, hopefully we will be testing this at some point. And so we want to write something that we can test. I think there are certainly empirical avenues that I'm excited about and that I think others on our author team are excited about. And some of us are working on some things. And I think there is some theoretical directions to take that we talk about a little bit. Part of it, I think, that can stem from this is so much of the work in this space, that there's not a lot, but it's looking at legacies in terms of a positive influence and positive impact. I'm not really much of a dark side type scholar, but there are people out there. And so I'm sure there's an interesting, twist to this and it's probably, you could probably argue, easier to come up with negative legacies that people have left and the impact of that. And so maybe looking at more of a negative side to it. I'm sure there's some theoretical angles there, but yeah, the goal I think here has always been, creating more opportunities in the future, whether they be empirical or theoretical, but hopefully not just end here.
And I also think just legacy in different contexts. So you obviously, I mean, this is anchored primarily in an organizational context, right? But if you start to think about it in terms of different contexts, maybe it doesn't work for management research, maybe it does, but certainly there's no doubt that legacy exists in other contexts. So that also seems like another direction that one could go.
Definitely.
Yeah. So Tyler, great work, great paper, and great effort representing your team. I hope they will listen to this and give you the credit that you are due for being willing to, you know, put on a jacket and a collared shirt and come and share your insights and perspectives. And just for all of our listeners out there, I really strongly encourage you to read this paper. Read it for purely for the clarity of the writing. Read it for the value of invoking a metaphor to illustrate a new concept, but also just read it for the nuance about legacy at a different level of the organization that that you can appreciate just from the work that's been done. And as I pointed out earlier, this was particularly poignant to me, given the fact that we've just lost someone in our department who I think has left a great legacy. So thank you for sharing this work. Thank you for putting all the effort, energy, and time into theorizing in this way and submitting your work to AMR. Appreciate it, Tyler.
No, thank you. This was a great experience. I've enjoyed this very much. So thanks to you for all of that.